What? Go.
Hold. I'm going to add coal. So hold on. Here's a clap for you.
That doesn't help me. It doesn't matter at all.
That's not how that works.
Yeah, it's fine.
You can look for that in the middle of the call.
I know. I got it. I'd see what time we're at. Go.
He's muted anyway. He's backstage pass only. He's not. He didn't get a guest pass.
Is he here?
Yeah, but you got to take this part out.
He's got to win something before he's allowed to talk.
I might not even edit this. I'm not going to lie to you. I might even not cut it.
No. You got to take this out.
This is your fault. I don't have to do anything. Hi, and welcome to episode 88 of Fully Boosted, a War Machine Hordes podcast. I'm Grant.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Brad.
And we are back. Pete beyond travel, so just the three of us turds here. So I don't think we have any news or anything exciting on that front. So what we decided to do this week is we didn't want to do any work, but we still wanted to put out a podcast. So luckily, our friends over at Battle Driven go and ask questions every week and get things to talk about. So we're just going to take all of them and answer them ourselves.
What are we, if nothing else, but pirates or privateers, you might say?
No, we're furthering the discussion they started.
I think would have been... Yeah, exactly. We're continuing the conversation.
Nice PC answer there. We're pirates.
Yeah.
And we're...
Arr!
Basically...
Well, shout out to them for doing all the legwork for us on this, and we appreciate it. So without further ado, let's jump in. So the first one I see on here is, if your meta has 2+ WTC or high level players that show up at events, does it change your perspective of what is good, either in a faction or with lists, in comparison to normal metas, you know, maybe that have 5 or 6 guys? I'm paraphrasing the question.
Can I take this one first?
Please.
Yeah, there never is a normal meta. Like, the meta is whoever you have to play against. So if your WTC players exist in your meta, and one plays, I don't know, Scorn, and one plays Mercenaries, well, then you have to plan to beat Scorn and Mercenaries.
No, but I get his question. So, for instance, we have Ireland in our meta and many other good players. I'm just going to use him because he specified WTC players. I mean, my thought of Rhett is higher than somebody else who plays with 5 guys, they don't have tournaments, and they play for fun, may think about what how good Retribution is.
Yeah, I'm hijacking into this right now because that was always a huge thing. When we started playing... going up toward the Philly area and actually like trying to get in to expand where we were playing at and stuff, I was always horrified. I was still playing Kador, and I was like, I don't have an answer for Rhett. Rhett scared the living bejesus out of me constantly. And then I'd go to, you know, TempleCon or something, and I'd run into a Rhett player, and I'd be like, oh, this is kind of easy. And it was always, Ireland said it his best. He was like, it's a lot different when you're playing not Mike Ireland Rhett. And, you know,
Mike said that to you?
Yeah. Mike
that sounds like something Mike would say.
Yeah, he has used that term before. He's like, isn't playing non-Mike Ireland Rhett fun?
Yeah, so it's funny because like, it's definitely not a negative because you actually do get, if you've got a very skilled player, especially if they play something specific and it's not just everything. It definitely does increase what you think of that stuff.
Yes, I think it can very easily skew your perception on a caster or a list or an entire faction if you're constantly banging your head against somebody of that caliber. It doesn't matter what they play, that'll change if they switch factions. I mean,
even as far as... Brad was a perfect example of this, is there was a long time where it was like, okay, you had an answer to Crix, and then you'd go to a local steamroller, and you had to rethink everything, because Brad Crix was very different than not Brad Crix.
Yeah, because if you knew Brad was coming, you're like, oh, I don't have to worry about Lich 2, and I don't have to worry about Scar 1. So, okay. So I got to think totally differently. And then Derek would bring both of those, and you'd be like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, I'd be shit.
But, Brad, I understand, but you have a different perspective when it comes to that kind of stuff. Like, you look at things a little differently. I think the average person would have their perception skewed by having a player like that.
I think I'm insulted, and...
I think you should be. I definitely didn't mean it in a negative way. I
think I'm insulted.
Okay, great.
I think you called me not a normal person, is what I heard.
Sure. But anyway, wow. That means right. You would agree. All right, moving on.
Well,
I'm going to sum this question up. Basically, how would you propose a more attractive means of submitting and collecting data in order to make data more representative? And what he's talking about is like a discount games, something that collects all of the data from tournament results and compiles.
So, to be fair, all the credit in the world to DGI for doing what they do, because it serves a purpose for their site, for the store, but at the same point, it's a lot of freaking work. But I think we already have one, don't we? I mean, Conflict Chamber is certainly a more elegant, as long as everything's getting submitted. Isn't Conflict Chamber basically just a more elegant design for that, or no?
Because yes,
you
and no.
Relies on people submitting.
So, yeah, it relies on people submitting, but I think a bigger thing with Conflict Chamber, and Conflict Chamber is great. I love Conflict Chamber. But in terms of, I think, what they're asking, there's no easy way. Say if you were trying to, like, look back in time at what lists were at, like, last year's WTC. There's no, if, like, you go to the Conflict Chamber site, you have no way of finding it. You have to find, like, a link that was posted in the event from 2 years ago, or from a year ago, and then, or just, like, remember the event number that generates in the URL. But, like, there's no good way to go through and just look through events on Conflict Chamber. You have to do it, like, with a little bit of additional research. You can try and find them all, or you can try and find the top list through DGI, but if you were just looking for all of the lists, not just the top three or eight teams or whatever it is, there's no easy way for that. And then beyond that as well, in each event for Conflict Chamber, we'll have like event statistics. It'll tell you like how many factions are played for each. It'll tell you which casters are played for each. But it doesn't give you like an overarching, like in 2018, in all the events, this is the layout. Like you have to do that all yourself.
And not even just that. If you're talking about how particular people or teams did in an event through Conflict Chamber, the results aren't there. What's there right. is the people that came and the breakdown of what was brought, but you're not going to be able to see who won, what was the top five, the top eight, the top ten. I think some type of integration like that would
who's
be
got, great. Who's got 40 to 80 hours a week to staff a website to actually track everything?
I actually think that we're closer than it seems. I think it's all community-driven, and I think it's all people doing it out of a labor of love. So the progress on it... is however much time they have to throw at it. But I think PG Swiss is getting tremendously close. The guys at PG Swiss or the guys at Conflict Chamber, or guy at Conflict Chamber, I should say. I don't know who started the communication with who, if it was kind of a mutual thing. But you can now move lists from Conflict Chamber events directly into PG Swiss.
Oh, really?
And then if you run the whole event through PG Swiss, it will track the stats for you. I can tell you that PG Swiss will put out things that are kind of more overarching that say, like, so far this year or month or whatever, this scenario has been played this many times, and it statistically ends in these fashions on these turns. Like, it'll show you how many times someone gets bottom of one on standoff, for example, as a percentage of how many times it happens. It'll be low, but it'll show it to you. It'll also show you, like, on average, what turn do people lose on Mirage. Mirage has been out for 2 weeks, so stats on that are probably pathetic. But
implies, like, when I ran mine, like, some people don't pay attention to that. Like, you also have, specifically for the turn the game ended,
right.
I'm talking about. Like, I put everybody as turn five because I was just like, nobody knew. Nobody was paying attention to that. So but that could be something that could easily be marked in the Steamroller sheet. You could just add another column up in the win-loss, and it's just like turn game, you know, turn end, right? Like, what game did it end? What turn did it end on? That's
going to be a huge player commitment. I mean, it's not just the people running it. It's also going to be the players having to report everything accurately. And It's a lot of work, but I guess, yeah, I didn't know you could export directly to it, so yeah, we are a lot closer than I guess.
I mean, and we touched on this last week when we had Chris on, where we talked about that, you know, in Magic and some of the other systems, they have the databases of decks and this other stuff. I mean, Brad's right. I mean, we're closer to having that type of thing where you can have all of this data available of, you know, assuming everybody uses this program, but, I mean, if you get to that point, I imagine they would.
Yeah, I think Magic, comparing it to something like Magic the Gathering would be a little tough, though, because, like, if they collect 50%, right, or let's say they collect 10%, you're probably still talking, you know, factors more data than you would get from
literally only
us
using
collecting
it as a comparison for that there is a database that exists, you know, hard stop. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's all. So, all right, let's move on. Does 3D terrain make an actual impact in your play, or does model volume only impact in line of sight between models, and is the scarcity of 3D terrain a net positive for the gameplay? I want to take this first. Yes, the scarcity of 3D terrain is a net positive for the game. 3D terrain looks great. It aesthetically is beautiful on the table, but in a game that comes down to millimeters, you can't have your fucking beautifully painted model halfway up on a hill falling off every 5 seconds where you have to stack it up on 2 dice and you don't put it back in the perfect position. Same with forests, same with every other piece of terrain, maybe with the exception of walls if they're weighted properly and buildings if they're big enough. I've always liked 3D terrain, but this game, I think it is only a detriment to the actual gameplay, at least when you're talking at the competitive level.
Part of me has to argue with you with this one. Just because, so is it a detriment to gameplay? Yes. Is it a, and this is the existence of 3D terrain, not the scarcity of it, but is it a detriment to the game? No. And I would say for as far as bringing new players in, having somebody come in and see just nothing on the table, because unless they go over to the tables, they see nothing. I think that hurts the aesthetic appeal, because let's face it, computer games have gotten to a point now where tabletops, part of what differentiates playing a strategy game in a tabletop format versus a computer format is the physical aesthetic of it, having the actual models, having the physical dice, having your opponent across from you. And I do feel like the lack of three-dimensional terrain does It hurts.
But you're assuming that person cares about that. And there's plenty of people that do. There's tons of people that don't play because they like 3D terrain. It's like, well, I can't tell the difference between the hill and the forest, and I don't get it if I don't see it in a physical aspect. But
yeah, I understand there's both people on the aisle there. There's mm-hmm. people who wouldn't bother playing with, if they walked up to a table and they saw 3D terrain, they wouldn't bother playing because they want to play this like super tight, super fast game. And part of it is the accuracy of the game and how tight the rules are. Part of it is because you play on a clock, so even moving trees can be annoying sometimes. I wish there was more of a prevalence of buildings being actual like nice set pieces I don't know. It bothers me less with the nicer looking 3D terrain. We've gotten to a point now where some of the neoprene printed graphics are gorgeous on their own right, and so you still have some of that visual aesthetic. I will always have 3D terrain on my personal table.
And I hate it.
And I know you hate it. And if I'm gonna play something where I want, I golf flag it. I have two dimensional terrain. All my 3D terrain that I use now is designed to either be left there or be designed to be put over a piece of neoprene terrain, so that if I am playing a friendly game where we're not on the clock, it's not as big of a deal. I don't know. I wish there was a. I'm waiting for the 3D the holographic terrain where it's the best of both worlds to come out.
Yeah, it's just like I can't tell you how many times I've knocked those fucking flags over or knocked. And again, this happens with other stuff. Flags, neoprene flags get moved off on tables all the time. I'm not saying there's not downsides to both, but it's just it especially when you look at like a convention or even a tournament, having that much terrain, even just for storage and for transporting purposes, it's It's literally just a hindrance, except for
aesthetics.
Well, yeah,
and that's what I was saying. So barring the aesthetics, there is no advantage to 3D terrain except for aesthetic, right? I mean, a convention can be run out of a single tote if you're using 2D terrain.
Yep.
You're not knocking models over. Everything is more clear. And that's why I play the game, right? So that's why I'm not one of those people. I'm not one of those people who's not going to play because I don't have access to three-dimensional, like, set piece terrain. But I miss it. It's definitely something I miss because it's part of why I play a tabletop miniatures game, is for the tabletop, for the physical pieces and everything else. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely something I miss.
Brad, you got anything? Or I think you fall on my side of the coin, but
I mean, I'm not going to add anything new to the conversation you guys haven't said. I personally prefer flat terrain. I don't mind if there's a golf flag setup to where there's 3D stuff on top and then the 2D stuff underneath. Generally, what I find happens is that by round two of the game, all the 3D stuff has moved to the side and the flat stuff is the only thing left on the table. So it's a little bit of an added inconvenience, but like aesthetically looks better if you leave it there.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, I'm generally, not going to be the one that's reaching for 3D terrain. So I think 2D is just generally better all around.
Sure. There's a question about Kador. We're going to skip that because we covered that. And then this isn't relevant to us, but I'm going to read it because I think it's funny. Kat Schwanky asks, why have you stolen my husband from me and how can I get him back? Alternatively, is there a support group for spouses of gamers who can't keep all their gaming stuff in their own damn office, even though they said they would, and now I'm picking up flash bits off the carpet because the vacuum is rebelling and this isn't what I signed up for?
Ooh, that's a good one. So I'll go first.
Go.
I don't build my own models, so don't worry about that. generally, if I'm off and Ash is off, I do stuff with her. So I think I'm good. You guys?
I mean, it helps that my wife is at least willing. Like, I mean, she plays Guild Ball. She has played War Machine, so she gets it. So I don't have that issue as much. But similarly, she would much rather I spend time with her and my daughter than go to a tournament for 12 hours on a Saturday. But you know.
Mine knows what she married and is arguably a saint for dealing with me on any level, let alone gaming.
I will agree with you on that. Next. I don't know if I want to answer that one. We'll come back to that, possibly.
No, ask it now. I want to know.
All right. Why are salty players the worst yet most vocal of any group?
Because they're salty?
I mean, so, like, if you're upset and you're trying to express that you're upset, like, you want to get your point across. Those that are content, like, don't speak up.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too is, especially if you're quote unquote salty, generally that means that something has changed. I'm not saying it's unwarranted, but normally those are the people who are not the majority. Because if something's broken and it's the majority of something, nobody calls a group going, "Oh my God, this is horrible," as a group salty. If it's one or two people who are like, my faction, which nobody else plays, is messed up, and they're complaining about it, even if it's a legitimate complaint, they're salty. And then you get people going, no, everything's fine. And they're sitting there going, I'm a Minions player in Mark II. Everything is not fine. And you're going to get more impassioned, more vocal as you get told.
Yeah, it's similar to Amazon reviews or product reviews or anything like it, right? The vocal majority are going to get their shit and they're going to like it or not and be quiet, but it's the ones that have the problems or got the wrong thing or got the defects. They're the ones that are going to speak up, or the people that like loved it and write reviews, you know, because that's what they do. But it's the same thing. I'm not going to complain if I'm just satisfied or even remotely satisfied. But if I was pissed about the game and didn't like the game and had nothing but negative stuff to say and was super upset and wanted change, I probably would be vocal about that. I mean, that tends to be how people are when they're angry at something, you know. As far as why they're the worst, I don't know, because they're probably super.
No, the worst is probably a dramatic overstatement.
I think it's the worst as in, I don't think he means the worst players, like the worst players. As far as skill goes, he means, like, why are they the worst?
Well, so could here's the joke, right? If you're being salty about salty players, you're not helping at all.
Yeah, and, like, if I can make one other point, like, I think it's probably a little rough to throw a blanket statement down about, quote-unquote salty players. I think, like, a big thing to realize is, like, the player is salty, they're frustrated because they are passionate, right? Like, maybe their efforts are misguided and they're, getting frustrated at the wrong things, but, you know, you don't become like that out of a state of not caring. So, like, generally, if those players are the ones that are around you, you know, do what you can as someone in the community to try and work with them and talk through the things and work through the problems together. I mean, generally, they're probably going to be frustrated either at how a model is doing or, like, why a list doesn't work or into something. Well, problem solve things together.
Yeah, I get that when it comes to most people, but I can think of some people that I would – there's no way that is a beneficial conversation or a, you know, productive use of your time.
I don't know. I feel like that's a gross overstatement.
Yeah. All right.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Let's move on. You are ahead on scenario by 1 point at the top of turn 4, and a 75% assassination is available, but you likely lose if it fails. Do you go for it, and to what extent does the scenario advantage or likelihood of assassination affect your answer?
Ryan, right, I just want to make sure I get all the pieces. Hold on, before we go into that, I just make sure I got all the pieces together. Say that one more time.
Go. No problem. You are ahead on scenario by 1. It's top of 4. There's a 75% assassination, but he says you lose if it fails. Do you go for it? And to what extent does scenario advantage or likelihood of that assassination affect your answer? I assume that means depending on if that percentage goes up or down or how many points you are up or down affect whether you take it or not.
Yeah, I think that's a...
There's so many variables in that.
Yeah,
like, as far as, like, that's like, okay, well, what's my table state? How am I feeling about my opponent? Do I like my list into the pairing and I'm up by 1, but I'm, like, looking at crumbling into the grind of Haley 3? Like, so many variables there.
Completely agree with you, but let's try to just, you know, I usually say I don't generally go for assassination. I'm with you, Ryan. If my long game looks okay and, you know, we've both feeded, there's no huge alpha swing about to come, I likely will try to play it out. I tend to play for scenario over everything. If the long game is looking bad for me and I've feeded but he hasn't and I'm about to get fucking smashed and not be able to score much going forward, I probably take it. It's a tough question.
So this is the question. So, like, the real question is... So even we just played a game today, and what would you call that? Especially once I had the EBT, once the pieces were obvious that I was going to be able to move stuff around. What do you want to call that? Like a 90%er?
Yeah, I would say that was at least a 90%er.
I still almost didn't go for it. I still almost went for the long game.
Yeah, I think that would have been a mistake. But
I do too, and I mean I went for it, right? So, but assassination. Just we play a dice game and. Playing the quote-unquote playing the odds, no matter how good your odds are, is always playing the odds. It's always possibly an issue. So, like,
I mean, without having like a board state in front of you to see, I think this question is almost impossible to answer. I think you're probably better off in scenarios where you're able to win on scenario. You're generally better doing that. You can take the same mentality. Is let's say you had the same exact circumstance for whatever reason. This is like theoretically, just about impossible. But theoretically, you were in a steamroller to where every round you're presented with the same exact situation. To where top of 4, you're leading on scenario, maybe a little behind on attrition just to make this like a thing to talk about, and you have a 75% assassination chance four rounds in a row. Well, I can tell you that based on your percentage chances, you're probably going to go 3-1, which means you don't win the event.
Yeah, I mean, that's something Mike has always preached, right? Is, you know, if you go for an 80%er, four rounds in a row, you know, you're not going to win the con. I mean, you might, but you got to look at it from the sense of, you know, 20% of the time in a 5-round event, you don't get that assassination, and if that costs you the game, then you don't win. You don't win a convention doing that.
Right.
You would probably take it, though, Brad.
So it depends. Like, if I'm a head-on scenario and, like, I'm a head-on attrition, you run your caster to the corner of the table and you just wait. If I'm losing on, I'm sorry, if I'm losing attrition pretty badly, even if I'm up on scenario, I think the question comes in, am I able to score 4 points this turn? Because generally, like, even if you can score 3 and, like, be up 4-0, but to do so means you give away your entire army, you're never going to be able to close that game out more than likely. Unless, like, you know that they're also not able to, like, stop the scoring on everything. So, like, you still score 2 on their turn, or, like, you still score 1, and they only score 1 or 2. I don't know. There's a lot in there to try.
And again, it does affect the board state, too, because, what was the one game? I can't remember if it was one of you guys I was playing. If it was, anyway, I was getting my ass completely handed to me. And I was playing Sorsha 1, and I had like a 50-50 shot in assassination. I think I was up on scenario, but it didn't matter because my entire army was just dying. So I went for, I think it was a bottom of 2 or a top of 3 assassination. And, you know, I got it. Versus, I know, Brad, you were just talking about a game where a little while ago you just let them kill your entire army and won.
Yeah, I mean, that was sometimes the plan in Mark II with some of those I was playing, was especially when it was just the race to 5, is I'm going to feed you my entire army, but we're going to be fighting like in your deployment zone. So I'm on all the scenario elements.
Yeah.
So like I said, I don't know. I kind of don't like the question. I mean, it's generated a good discussion, I guess, but I kind of don't like the question.
I like those kind of questions. They're just difficult to answer because it's very situational, but I get what he was going for there. All right. The next one is there room to make smaller point games competitive, i.e. 50-35? I think the answer is yes, but the problem is they've designed the game around 75.
So you just answered your question, so no, the answer is no.
No, but you could run a 50-point tournament. Like, sure, you could do that, but for the full feel of the game...
I think that... If you're going to look at all factions, you can run a 50-point tournament. You can run a 35-point tournament. I think unless it's with new players who don't know how to, or maybe not don't know is the wrong word, but aren't as experienced at taking advantage of the minutia of different factions, I think that anything smaller than 75 in a tournament, and you completely biased the game. So certain factions, Kador, you put a small point value into Kador, they love it. All of their support will kill you. Trolls wants nothing to do with a small point game because the larger the points are, the more meat they get to take in their list because they have a arguable minimum support value that they have to take to have their list function the way they want it to. And this is true for some of the other factions too. I don't think that there is 75 is a good spot. I think that as soon as you start messing with point totals, you are playing a slightly different game with different aspects. For new players, I think it's a great thing because it lets you learn modules, but you don't learn the support of those modules. You only learn that module, if that makes sense.
I don't know. I zoned out for a minute, but sounds right.
I have that effect.
Oh, yeah, I'll agree. Ryan, this one's probably more for you because I don't have experience with this, but weigh the pros and cons of owning a limited faction, cost effectiveness of owning something that won't expand versus expanded options of full factions.
All right. Do you want the low salinity level response?
You've owned conversions. I mean, give your honest thoughts on owning conversions. Would you do it again?
I've really enjoyed the factions. I'd have to say yes. It's not like I don't sit here and go, I regret buying into conversions. So as far as the limited faction goes, from a financial aspect, if you're just going to buy stuff and make competitive lists, I don't think it's necessarily any cheaper. If you're one of these people who's like, I want to own everything in the faction, then it's cheaper because it's a smaller faction. I don't think it's any cheaper necessarily to have competitive lists. Past that, as far as like what they do and their shtick, I'm not sure. I'm really still kind of torn on Convergence as a whole.
Put Convergence aside, just limited faction in general.
Well, I mean, that's my experience, right, is with Convergence.
But I'm saying not going into the pros and cons of Convergence.
Of Convergence itself. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a really neat way for them to expand a incredibly bulky SKU count of a game with new ideas and new shticks and new story and new models without having to try to find a place for them. I think for the game, they're a phenomenal benefit. I think as far as someone who's going to go into it, just make sure you understand that there's a chance that you're going to stagnate, and if you're going to play competitively, stagnating means you don't play competitively anymore. Not that it's a guarantee, but it's certainly a possibility. There's definitely a risk involved with it.
I'd say one benefit is that you have less stuff, so there's less... I don't want to say less like temptation to try other things, but you have less stuff accessible to you, so you almost like force yourself into like, okay, well, this is my pairing, so I'm playing this pairing,
yeah.
And that's going to be it because this is the competitive pairing. This is the one I've chosen. This is the best one, and I'm playing this for extended period of time. If that doesn't bother you, then it's probably great. You kind of force yourself and you don't go back and forth with caster ADD as much because you know what's good and what's not good. And until the meta cycles, you probably are playing a very similar, two similar lists.
Yeah.
Con, obviously, is that they don't get new stuff, and what you could be buying may be the only releases you will ever get. So you got to hope that the faction is balanced properly and competitively viable for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would do it. I've thought about doing it just for that reason. Just like, hey, this will force my hand. I'm only going to be able to play. There's only five casters, so great. I'm going to get really good with five casters, and that's going to be the end of it. But I agree with you, though, Ryan. Financially, it may not be any better because, I mean, you know, depends on what you have to buy because the lists still change from time to time.
Yeah.
So
it's definitely as far as like the financial. I think that's almost a joke in that a competitive two-list pairing is going to be a competitive two-list pairing. It doesn't matter what faction you're playing.
Yep. The next one is about standings and standings on factions based on how people place. I think that's also something we talked about last week and the last couple weeks pretty significantly. So I think we will skip that one. Tim has a pretty lengthy question here, so I'm going to just break it down, and then we can just answer it in parts, because it's definitely too long to handle in one piece. So,
all right.
The first part is, what is cheating in War Machine, and how should we as players and community members respond to it? So let's just start there. Brad, go ahead.
Willfully misrepresenting rules, or die rolls, including misrepresenting movement.
Yeah, I was going to say table state, but yeah, that sounds about right.
Yep. I mean, purposely moving something too far, nudging models. I mean, I'd even consider something... No, I'm not going to say that. It's not, but it's just... That's just shitty sportsmanship, which is you know, there's a gray area there.
There's a gray area of shitty sportsmanship
versus...
I'm going
to stick with just... Yes. Knowing rules and playing them incorrectly is
intentionally.
Intentionally, yeah. I mean, is the black and white of it. Is cheating the act of receiving advantage through misapplication of the rules? And if this is insufficient, how do we judge intention?
Yeah, so I think, and I'm going to take some stuff like I grabbed through like in-work training for like Six Sigma and all that bullshit, is you always assume positive intent. Like, you always assume that your opponent, if there's something that they're doing incorrect in the rules, it was never intentional they were doing it that way. So you always assume positive intent, which means that you're giving the benefit of the doubt. Say again?
You have a lot more fun games that way.
Right. But then beyond that, like, it makes it so that until someone's developed a pattern, that you can still kind of hold them to it. I mean, I can't think of any one player out there that hasn't gotten a rule incorrect.
Right.
Even sometimes to their detriment. You know, I'll be the first to tell you, when Shrikes first came out, I thought they were absolutely busted because I didn't understand how I, you know, when I read the rules, I didn't think about it all too much. And I was like, man, these are power and strength 15 tramples. That's nutty. Well, I was adding the power of the weapon, which is on the back of the card, says to do to the weapon again.
you were combo striking the trample.
Basically, I mean, all the rule basically says is that when you trample, use the power of the, like, you're able to add the power of the weapon to your strength. Well, I was adding that again the power and strength on the front of the card.
Yeah.
Like, this is stupid. How am I getting 3 dice to hit power and strength 15 tramples out of a 6-point model?
Answer
is I'm not.
What was one Pete was just doing where he was screwing himself? Oh, he was playing Onslaught like it was Battle Group only.
That's pretty brutal.
I was like, Pete, you turned an already shitty rule into an already shitty spell even shittier. I would agree with that. I don't know how you judge intention, to be honest. I don't.
So here's the catch with that, right? At least for me, we're not getting paid to play this game. It's not like it's a professional sport where it's, I mean, once... Playing it one, like, playing against one person one time, you can't judge intention unless they're like, ha 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 ha.
Yeah,
like,
mean,
you
unless,
know what I mean?
Unless
they're sitting over there with the snidely done hurt, you know, the mustache and the cat on the arm. Like, you can't judge it.
Unless you look down and look up as you see them turn a die over while you're marking damage.
Yes,
you know what I mean? Like, that's the only...
More so when I was going with the assuming positive intent is not so much that, like, you have to take... I can't express what I'm trying to say right here. More so what I'm getting at is that until someone makes a pattern of what they're doing, in that every time that you correct them, or any time like they get corrected by someone, they continually keep going back to the way that like benefits them. Like if it's intentional... or if it's obvious that they're like doing this because it's to their benefit, that's when I think you're able to start doing things.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. Pattern, I think, becomes the big deal there because, like you said, we all get rules wrong. Every single person in this game that has ever played it has gotten a rule wrong at some point. And some to your benefit, some to your detriment. That's just how it goes. You read and you misinterpret stuff. That the pattern and seeing it over and over again is... where you could start to decide, okay, I know he's doing that on purpose because he's done that 3 different times in a game with me. And we've corrected it. You know what I mean? Like that's when it becomes, okay, we know they're doing this on purpose. What's an example of being too harsh with someone found to be a cheater under any understanding of the term? And what's an example of not being harsh enough?
Has anybody been hung? I don't know. I don't know. Again, it's not like we're having, I mean, yes, there's, you know, there's prize pools and stuff like that. But it's not like it's a professional esport or a big prize pool. No, I'm not saying that, but what it does is it's not like the police are getting involved or anything like that. I mean, I think the worst you could have would be something like getting banned from a location or banned from a circuit of events where the community has basically said, we're not playing with you. And at that point, is there anything harsher than that? Not really. Is there anything, is that too harsh?
I think you could be blackballed from the entire community where, you know, everybody knows and you show up at a convention and you're not allowed to play. I mean, that would, I would say, be possibly the harshest thing that you could do to somebody.
Yeah.
That's
too harsh. if it's gotten to that point where you've been caught multiple times cheating and an event says, no, we don't want you here. We're playing a game to have fun.
I don't think that's too harsh.
Maybe you're having fun.
You're talking about something trying to be at a high level where everyone's trying to be clean and the best player that they can be. And I don't if somebody was caught multiple times on multiple events, I wouldn't have a problem with somebody not being allowed to play at a convention. I just wouldn't. I don't think it's acceptable at any level, whether we're getting paid or fucking not. I mean, there's a social contract playing a game, and that's that you're going to abide by the rules.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, not harsh enough. I guess that would be the opposite. Somebody getting caught
condoning it.
Yeah, multiple times, and you know, admitting to cheating, and then being like, "Oh, okay, that's fine."
Like, I think the wrong thing to do is, like, let's say you go out to an event with like your friends, or like you're in a team event. And like at the end of the game, you're talking with your buddy about like how their game went, and they say to you like, you know, I was like round three, I was in a really tough spot, so I took this charge, where like, I kind of had to fidget around a model, and like the line wasn't that clean, my opponent let me do it. Like, your opponent shouldn't let you do things. They either happen or they don't.
I think pre-measuring has helped a lot of that, because if somebody is measuring something, if you can, it doesn't always work this way, because people are on a clock, they're playing fast. You know, if I have a question, I mean, it happened today with me and Ryan. Like, hey, can you just double check that measurement? You know, he asked, hey, are you sure you're out of Starcross? Oh, let me double check. I mean, you can make hold people to try to play as clean as possible. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes models get moved, people pick models up, it gets dicey, and oh yeah, no, I was definitely in, and there's nothing you could do about that, unfortunately. But I think that's when the pattern starts to get, where it's like, hey, start asking the person to, hey, can you just put a proxy base down the next time you do that and just double check that with your measuring stick? And if they keep refusing to do that, you know, I don't know what to tell you, but that's... It has... Anyway, pre-measuring has made it a little easier to, at least from the measuring perspective. The rules, you know, you got to be willing to check someone's rules if you think it's wrong.
We're also talking the difference between, and this comes into that gray area, right? But the difference between a casual game and a like a tournament game or something too. If someone, yeah, that was a banana charge. I mean, is that bad? I'm talking myself out of my comment right now as I'm saying it, because it sets up a bad habit to get in during a tournament game. But I don't know.
Well, I think we should all, as players, strive to play the cleanest game possible. And I hold my opponent, again, I'm speaking competitively, I try to hold them to the same level I hold myself. I'm harsher on myself because I want to be, because I don't want to be the one that gets, that someone's like, oh, hey, like, that was, you measured that wrong, or you did a banana charge there, or
even worse, you're the one who goes, oh, I got Grant.
Yeah, right. I mean, you don't want to be the guy that someone walks to the table is like, oh, fuck, great. I'm going to have to sit here and watch this motherfucker and every move that he makes and every measurement he makes and every dice roll.
I wouldn't play that game.
Well, you would in a convention.
I make you play that game, Ryan. And, if you don't think that I mismeasure everything against you, you are sadly mistaken.
So what I think the cheating thing kind of leads into an interesting conversation about sportsmanship, because I think that those two go hand in hand, and it is a very gray area between what is cheating and what is somebody just being a shitty player, right? Like, so there's a difference between, obviously, somebody blatantly cheating and somebody doing something like, you know, a charge that you didn't think was clear, but they, you know, refusing to remeasure something, you know, or picking a model up too quick when you've asked them to measure, or just sloppy play versus cheating.
That's one thing, but then also being like, hey, do you have any way around incorporeal? And they go, oh, no. And then, you know, you move your incorporeal model up and they go, oh, yeah, I forgot this model had true sight.
Yeah.
And they did that to you like three times in a game.
Yeah, like gotchas where it's like, oh, do you have any threat extension? It's like, no. And then it's like, oh, well, you know, and then later they're like, oh, well, I had this, but you asked about, you know, spells or something stupid like that. You're like, oh, well, you know, come on.
Well, I don't know.
I mean, even something similar, this is what I was going to use earlier, but like I said, it's not cheating. It's just kind of like, it's just a little aggravating. It's like somebody rolling in a dice box and saying, I'm going to re-roll everything that comes out of the box. Okay, great. Until they don't. Or saying, you know, or I'm going to pick up everything that looks cocked, You know, that's if it's touching something else and not flat on the table, I'm picking it up, and then not when it's a six. You know what I mean? Like, I've seen some of that in tournaments, too, where, and it's just like, all right, well, just be consistent, you know? You picked up the one that was out of the box, but you left the five, so...
Yeah, so which
little,
is it?
Little unclear here about how you want to play. And that gets a little dicey, and I actually personally have a hard time dealing with that because I'm just not the kind of person. I generally don't like to call people on things. I generally don't like to be the guy that's like, hey man, like, you can't do that. I think that goes with the intent that I try to just assume that everybody is playing with the best intentions, and you get under stress and pressure, especially as the game goes on, and some people do things they wouldn't normally do, say, on turn one.
Yeah, exactly.
You got anything on that, Brad? You're a pretty chill player, so you don't even really probably think about that stuff a whole lot.
Not tremendously.
But like,
I don't know.
I mean, I'm sure you've seen some things that people have done in games that you were just like, okay, that's how we're gonna play. I think you tend to fall in the camp with me of you probably just let it slide and keep playing.
No, I'll call him on it.
Yeah.
And then we go from there. It's never convention level wise, but like, I've run enough of my own local events. Like, why to make judge calls where, like, not so much people win and lose because of them, but like, it's like a really important charge. And if the model's in, it dramatically swings how the game's going to play out. And if they don't, then like, it's really good for one and not for the other. So while we're making the call on my game, I'll go through and do everything I would do as if I was being called for a judge call. My opponent doesn't agree that I'm doing things correctly in terms of like how I want to go through and measure everything with them. Then we call a judge over. Because I'm pretty certain that I'm going to be going through and taking the time to make sure I get my measurements right. So I'm going to hold you to the same thing. And if you're moving quick on it, I'll do them with you. And if you don't agree with me, then we have a judge do it.
So this is kind of funny about this because I feel like, and I don't know if this is just one of those where it's like, I've drank in the Kool-Aid, so I'm remembering the past worse than it was. But so much about this game, especially now that it has pre-measuring, that when you run into that kind of stuff, is because it's so easy to just go, you know what, let's just get a judge. Having that ability, because there's other game systems that's not, or what didn't used to be an option in. And it's the difference is the community's view of that. If you're, and again, this is more so at a convention than at a local event. But if you're ever questioning it, it's not like, oh God, you okay, let's call a judge. Like, for the most part, you don't get that. You get okay, we can call a judge. Like, it's the there's no onus.
There's no stigma on calling a judge.
No. There's no stigma on asking somebody to measure it or use a stick or here I have a stick. Or throwing a proxy down. Like, the community itself is just better than that. And
I don't think he was making a comparative statement. He's just saying they're better than than not calling it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because the rules are tighter or if because it's remnants from like the press ganger program where everything was so tight and so specific. Like, every tournament had somebody who just ran tournaments. They still do. Every tournament more or less has a judge at it. Even the dinkiest little tournament is going to have effectively a judge at it. And I think that helps alleviate most of the issues where you'd be like, huh, you know, this is kind of odd. Like, why is this a thing? And it's just, I don't know, it's just better than a lot of the other systems out there, and it supports just cleaner play.
Sure. All right, I found a couple more questions, so let's hit them, and then I think we'll wrap it up for this week. So there's a lot of talk about X matchup being good or bad depending on the faction. How much time do you spend playing into those matchups that you're either heavily favored or heavily unfavored, and what benefits, if any, do you get from playing those types of games?
So at least for me, and I think this is true kind of just with the meta that we're in, I feel like most players will show up with a steamroller pair or with at least a list pair. Maybe not when they're going to play in a steamroller, but like two lists they're considering playing. So generally, you don't hit like the crazy slam dunk games, and you don't hit the like the worst case scenarios, which I think is almost better. Like you're practicing the matchups that you're more likely to see, more of the 50-50 games where it's going to come down to player skill. Like I can very easily go through and explain why, like Jaga. And a Sacral Vault into like any Ghost Fleet list is like a doomsday scenario for the Ghost Fleet player. Going through and playing that, like as long as the person that's playing Jaga Jaga is like putting their pieces where they even have, like, let me phrase that, because there's no like this piece has to do this. It's my caster needs to be on the table. So like, don't get your caster assassinated. You're probably in a grid spot. I don't know. Go ahead.
So I'm going to disagree with you here, because I think if you are looking to go to a convention and win a Masters, I think a lot of the top tier players will tell you that they actually spend more of their time playing into their bad matchups, or if not more, a very good amount, because you need to know how you're going to beat Gatsby 3 Nine Slayers. You need to know how you're going to beat Haley 3, and whether or not you have a list that brings it to a 40-60 or a 30-70 or whatever it may be, you need to be prepared to play those matchups. So while, yes, I think on your average game night, you're probably not seeing them. I mean, people get asked all the time, hey, can you bring this Matt? You know, Ryan's asked me, hey, can you bring Haley 3? Because I want to see how this list does endure, because I know I'm going to see her, because we've got fucking five Signar players.
That's not what I'm describing, Grant. That's not what I'm describing. Haley 3 is a good steamroller pair, or like a good steamroller list that you should expect to play. What I was just describing is a silver bullet. Like, you shouldn't have any reasonable chance of winning that game under nearly any circumstance.
So you're saying the Irish 2 matchup into Wormwood.
Yeah, you're taking a further extreme of
Against like Vlad 2 Armored Core or Haley 3 or like the Dreamer or Lich 3. Insert popular strong list here. Playing against those is like the best thing you can do. And some of those might be tough matchups. Playing against your silver bullet to see if you can beat the odds is like an exercise in futility. Like,
I think we both interpreted that question differently.
I also feel that there is one time to play into your silver bullet, and that is the one time you need to play into it, because you can think something's a silver bullet and then play into it and be like, huh, okay, well, my list is slightly different than what the meta is using right now, and hey, this isn't a silver bullet to me because of this factor that I didn't think about. I do think you should play into that horrific matchup once just to give yourself an idea of, is this as bad as I think it is? Oh yes, this is as bad as I think it is. Good, I will always dodge this.
I think that's fine if it's a list where you're not sure, but I agree with Brad. I mean, if you're talking like an 80-20, a 90-10, or what, like something that is literally like, you can't play into this, yes, there's no point in doing that. Except if the first time, if it is a list where you just don't see it, and you're like, I don't know how bad this is for me. I mean, we've all done that, where it's like, I'm not sure, I'm thinking about this, let me see it, and you're like, okay, that was fucking terrible, I would never play that, okay, great, now I know that. So I think there's a little bit of value in it, but I wouldn't do it more than once.
Yeah.
And again, only in the circumstances where you may not know that it's as bad of a match as it turns out to be. So going off that, how often do you think people over-exaggerate how good or bad a matchup is? Are there truly 80-20s or worse in the current game outside of, you know, some terrible casters?
God, yes. There's definitely 80-20s in the game. How much do they get over-exaggerated? I don't know. For myself, every game I play.
Yeah, but you turn 50-50s into 30-70s. So I don't know. I've never seen anybody that can line models up on the table and at deployment and go, I think I just lose. It's like, we have rolled zero dice. How can you say that?
I played an Orion Destruction Initiative list into a Kara Sloan player and almost lost the game. And that is by far a silver bullet. Like, I had no business in even losing a jack in that game. And I opened myself up to like three different swings from Kara on me.
Yeah, but that's not just, the time. You've done that always. It's not like you got touched in a bad place. And
it's just, I don't know why I put it on the table. What did I say? The game we just played today. I put the list on the table and I went, I hate it. I don't like it at all.
Yeah, but that wasn't the same as...
This actually works. This is a lot of fun. I don't know. That's just me personally. I do think in general that the echo chambers and the community as a whole does over exaggerate sometimes what a bad matchup is, because they look at it in a vacuum and they say this is horrible. But then you add terrain and you add objectives and scenario and dice into it, and all of a sudden now it's not the 90-10 everybody thought it was. It's now just, you know, now it's a 70-30, which is still a horrific look, but it's not as bad as everybody thinks it is. I do think stuff is blown out of proportion.
I tend to agree. I think people will have a bad experience. Dice can be a huge factor, and they'll look at a match and think it was worse than it could be, or possibly was, especially if you were to re-rack and play it again. Maybe there was a gotcha, maybe there was, you know, some bad placement. If you were to play it a second time, I think maybe it may not be so bad. That being said, yeah, there certainly are 80-20s. I don't think there's any question about that.
Brad, speak. You're the most seasoned of us. Are we just blowing hot air out our tails here?
I play a lot. I usually always bring a steamroller pair, so I'll play games that I would expect to play in steamrollers. If someone wanted to like play their like silver bullets, like where there's a list that like just reasonably can't win, then I'll do it. And I think the best example I can give for that is like a Jaga Jaga or like a Band of Heroes or something into Ghost Fleet. Like you have a lot of RFP, or you have targeted RFP to you know, put pressure where you need it. Like, I'll play the game if you want me to, but, like, I can tell you that it's going to be rough for me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just play a lot.
But do you think there's 80-20s?
Oh, yeah. I believe that those matchups exist. I just don't think it's prudent to practice them. I think you're probably, in a steamroller scenario, just going to be playing your other list. There's no formats. There's singles formats for the most part anymore. List lock doesn't exist. Like that matchup, if it's that bad for you, just doesn't happen.
I think you're listening. I think you're paying attention to Total War, because the question wasn't about playing them. This was a separate question.
Oh, good. Yeah. What was the question?
I think we're done here. We're gonna move.
Way to rat him out.
Well, as soon as I realized what he was saying, I'm like, he didn't hear the question at all. He didn't realize we moved on.
Nope, not in the slightest.
That's okay.
I swear we're not phoning this episode in.
I mean, I wasn't. My answers were truthful.
I'll ask this because maybe one of you have read them. I have not read them completely through. You have opinions on the Monpok rules now that they're released.
Didn't look at them.
Nope.
I read them a little, but I did not... I did not get to finish and really get a feel for it, so I will defer. I thought maybe one of you two may have read them.
I've read comments online from those that I trust their opinion of them saying that the rules are really tight and it's really cleaned up compared to what it used to be. I mean, again, I didn't play it whatever it used to be, but it was in a state where it was... maybe needlessly complicated, and that's now removed while still having all the tactical elements.
Yep, sounds good. and the last one, while SR 2018 has brought some of the zones closer together for a more dynamic experience, does the relative sparseness, of terrain continue to allow ranged weapons to dominate zone control?
Ask that one more time. So sorry.
So essentially, even though SR 2018 brought some of the zones closer together, like in what's it called fucking Mirage, where the circles are relatively close to each other. Does the relative sparseness of terrain continue to allow ranged weapons to dominate zone control?
I don't think so. I mean, terrain is its most prevalent point. I mean, since SR 617, I guess. But, like, terrain is always hugely relevant. I haven't felt that you're usually getting shot off the table.
I mean, unless you're playing into gun lines, like, they'll do that, but I don't know.
Yeah, but only if you let them. I don't know. I don't know.
Go play Gibbs's Sloan list and let me know if he lets you shoot him off the table or not. If you let him shoot you off the table or not.
Yeah, it's pretty much as bad as it's usually going to get.
That's fair.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree. I mean, terrain is certainly at the most dense that it's ever been. I mean, unless you're playing in a meta where they're not following the guidelines of 6 to 8 pieces, and I tend to lean towards 8 when I set tables up, I don't know if that's... I mean, guns are still really strong. Like, I think pre-measuring still leaves guns to be at this probably one of the strongest they've ever been in the game. That being said, I don't think we're dominated. I don't think gun lines, like, are it. I don't think it's, you know, gun lines are get the fuck out. But they're strong. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
All right. I think that is all the questions that Battle Driven got asked. So that is all the questions that we're going to answer. So I want to give them another shout out for doing that for us. We appreciate that. And maybe next week we'll actually come up with some of our own material to talk about.
Maybe I'll listen to the questions.
You were good for most of the cast. We lost you there. We lost you there towards the end.
I missed one. I have settlement management. For those that are not playing Total War Warhammer, it's astounding. It's what 13-year-old me wanted back when I used to play Warhammer Fantasy. I'm like, man, these models are really cool, but having to build and paint them really sucks. And I took that mentality into adulthood with War Machine. I was like, man, building and painting these models really sucks. I'm gonna paint a guy. I'm gonna pay a guy to do it. This is so much better.
That game is really good.
Yeah. Nah, it's fucking amazing, so I would also recommend that. Unfortunately, it's never on sale, so even the Steam sale wasn't really that that cheap, but...
Grant, you're an adult, just go buy it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know that I own it, right? Like, I have hundreds of hours in that game. Okay, just checking. So, all right, guys, does anybody have anything else?
No.
All right, great. We will be back next week then. I'm Grant.
I'm Ryan.
I'm still Brad.
Thanks for listening to Battle Driven.